Dan, La Bonne Maigot, a 3-year-old woman-owned specialty food producer operating out of the greater New York City area, is a company I became fascinated with. Maigot, which is French for hidden treasure, specializes in African, Middle Eastern, and South Asian-inspired condiments and culinary ingredients. The company creator, Naomi Mobed, is here to tell us about how she is succeeding. Naomi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, first, Naomi, tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, how long you've been here, and what inspired you to begin this quest for your own company.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I actually am born in Pakistan, and my family migrated to the U.S., when I was about 11 or so years old. But we had the benefit of living in a number of different countries around the world. My father was with an U.S. oil company at the time, so we got moved everywhere. We eventually came to settle in the States, and then I grew up, as they say, and eventually went to university here and then went overseas for graduate work, and had a pretty successful career in banking. And again, I lived and traveled all over the world. You know, during that time, food has always been a passion. So if it wasn't graduate school, it was going to be culinary school. And it's one of those dreams that you keep postponing as you deal with everyday life, right? You get comfortable in what you're doing and how you're doing it, and you keep thinking, oh, well, tomorrow I'm going to do this, or I'm going to pursue what I really would love to do. And in my case, I moved to Dubai, a few years ago, and I realized that I wasn't doing what I love to do, and I wasn't living where I love to live, and I had to make some pretty speedy changes to my life. So at that point, I decided to go headlong into a career in the food industry, although I didn't know what shape it would take at the time, and I knew I had to come back home to be able to do it. So the U.S. market is, the U.S. specialty food market has changed so much over the last few years while I've been away. You have, sophisticated diners who have been introduced to spices from all around the world, and that meant that, I had an entry point and a language with which to communicate with foodies and food adventurers who wanted to try, South Asian, African, and Middle Eastern cuisines, but done my family's way.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Before I turn it over to Dan, what does your company specialize in, and why do you call it La Bonne Maigot?
La Bonne Maigot? Well, Maigot, means a lot of different things. And it's one of those words that, really can be defined in a multitude of different ways. So it actually, we rested on the definition of, hidden treasure. And because we're so hidden, based in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, you can drive through our little village and miss it completely. But it really is a treasure of a village, very leafy, just 5 minutes, 7 minutes outside of Princeton, New Jersey. And we also realized that a lot of the flavors that we were going to bring out in the way that we wanted to do it were hidden. And so it seemed like, the perfect perfect word. Why French? Because, traditionally it has been the language of gastronomes and foodies. So we went with a French name to the company. I also grew up speaking French, so it was very close to my heart as well. And a lot of the processes and techniques that we rely on in making our preserves and chutneys and other products are, from a French technical background.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to Dan now. I'm sure he has some questions.
Sure. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm fine, Naomi. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I can't think of a place anywhere else in the world that is more meat and potatoes than the United States. Steak, baked potato, salad, glass of red wine. That's a great meal. So you're trying to change the or bring to that rather bland American palate that new spices and treasures from all over the world. So how you been doing?
Well, first of all, I don't think the American palate is very bland. Now, I grew up in the Midwest. So from the time I was 11 to the time I was about 16, 17, I grew up in a place called Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And, you know, growing up in the U.S. as well as, you know, so many different parts of the world, you know, you start realizing that there are commonalities to food, you know, not just major divisions. The U.S. has been introduced to spices very early on as, you know, the U.S. started exploring the world around it. So you had the black pepper trade, you had, you know, vanilla, you had rose. All of those ingredients have been incorporated in U.S. cuisine from, you know, a very early time period. I mean, we're talking 17, 1800s. So, you know, the adventure with spices is not new. It's a question of how it's going to be used and, you know, what stories you really want to be able to tell with them. And then, frankly, how good something is going to taste with it. So, you know, I think the adventure with spices is not new to North America.
So who is your ultimate customer?
My ultimate customer is a customer that respects fresh food because all of our ingredients are fresh. We do not use canned, processed, or frozen. It's a customer who wants to know what is in that jar. We are fully transparent with our ingredients and use, honestly, the highest quality of spices blended by some master blenders here in the United States who we work with and companies that are small businesses that have a very strong ethos about how they grow or source particular spices. So, for example, we work to source our saffron. We work with a company called Rumi Spice, which, you know, the co-CEOs are ex-U.S. Marines who were based out in Afghanistan, and they started working with farmers in Afghanistan, converting them from other, you know, crops that were perhaps not as friendly to, you know, cash crops, including saffron. And they're a B-certified corporation. The quality of the saffron is exemplary. And, you know, we're able to really identify the source of the saffron down to the farm. So, you know, we have similar collaborations in the way that we source our vanilla, for instance, or the way that we source some of our blends that we use for our dried fruit marmalades. So, you know, the customer is somebody who respects that supply chain, the quality of the ingredients, and, of course, one who, you know, loves to be able to tinker around in the kitchen, even if they are simply just opening a jar.
So just to make sure I understand, is the bulk of your business retail direct to the consumer, or do you supply restaurants?
We do both, actually. The bulk of it is retail to customers and through our e-commerce channels. We sell through over 200 retailers across 40 states today. And then we have a small part of our business, which is also food service, but it's considerably smaller at the moment.
So you have a website where people can go in and begin to explore the condiments and the spices that you have?
Absolutely. They can get us at www.lebonmago.com.
Can you spell that for them, please?
Of course. It's LEBONMAGOT.com.
And you yourself, does your company have a bricks and mortar presence?
We do not at the moment, actually. We will actually be moving into some new premises, offices, and warehouses starting September of this year, if all things go the way that they're intended. But we're not intending to have, you know, a bricks and mortar store. You know, our whole approach is to sell through other retailers.
What percentage of your business do you think comes from online sales?
Online is relatively small at the moment. Online is, I would say, about 15% or so, only because we haven't really pushed that channel the way we ought to be doing. We are steadily expanding. You know, we're looking to launch our Amazon presence fairly soon. But right out of the gate, we actually had some interesting food service customers and retailers, and that's where we focused on, you know, where we focused our efforts. You can imagine we're a small company, at the moment entirely self-funded. So we've got to, you know, really drill in on into channels where we feel we're going to get the most robust returns, you know, given how we started. So we're moving into online fairly steadily.
You, in your introduction, Don said that you're a 3-year-old company. You're now.
We are. We're babies.
Yeah. You know, you said you were in 40 states.
Yes.
And for distribution, I'm curious as to, what was your marketing strategy to go out and find these relationships in these 40 states?
Well, this was completely inverse to my marketing strategy. When I, you know, when I launched the company and really was targeting, you know, retailers to sell to, it was in my immediate area, you know, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, you know, that was really about it. That was my focus. However, we did the Fancy Food Show in 2016, the Summer Fancy Food Show, and that just hurdled us. It catapulted us in front of an array of retailers across a multitude of locations, and effectively it validated our flavors and pretty much told us, you know what, we're on the right track. And as a result of that, our sales became incredibly diffused. So, you know, now we're actually working in each of these states to deepen our relationships as well as broaden them. So it means, of course, taking on new retailers, but also working on a strategy to increase the churn or number of sales per client. So, you know, our marketing strategy has changed a little bit as a result of the trade shows that we were showing at.
So at 3 years into your company development, how many people do you have working for you?
We actually, you know, work with a network of brokers and distributors, as well as with a very small team who focuses on operation, production, fulfillment, and finance. So we're looking at about 4 people who work with us in-house and then a network of brokers and distributors.
So you talked a moment ago about how your one of your next objectives is to deepen your relationship with your existing distribution? How will you go about doing that?
Well, you do that by, you know, assessing whether the sizes that you're currently selling at are adequate. Are they too large? Do you need to reduce that? You know, you look at your price points to determine whether, you know, pricing is a limitation. You see, we're in a, by starting out with condiments and chutneys, it's already a fairly slow-moving category, you know. So as a result of that, what can we do to till these sales faster? So those are some of the things that, you know, we're looking at.
So I'll ask you one more question, then I'll turn it over to Don.
Sure.
You talk about three different cultures, African, Middle Eastern, and South Asian.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, I would guess, the least well-known of the three would be African in the United States. Would that be true?
I would say it depends on which part of Africa. You know, our approach with any of our products, and, you know, when I started the company, the angle that I took was that we're starting with preserves and condiments. We want to be able to expand into other categories. And when we talk about Africa, Middle East, and South Asia, you know, we're really looking at flavors that can be integrated across some of these locations and areas. You know, I'm not necessarily seeking to launch a product that is 100% authentic to, oh, this is a North Indian product or this is a South Indian product. It really is a fusion of different flavors and inspirations that my family has picked up from around the world and that we are bringing to our table that we're wanting to share with others. So, you know, the proof is really in the taste. It really comes through in the taste, so it's tough to talk about it.
Good. Thank you. Don, back to you.
Oh, thank you. I have to tell you, I'm listening, and I'm amazed how you have really taken leadership of this small business and applied some big business ideas to it. You're to be congratulated.
Thank you.
Having said that, I'm going to ask you a stupid question. What is chutney and how is it done? I see it all the time, but I've been in the Middle East, in Asia, etc., and I still don't understand it.
No problem. Chutney actually originates from a Hindi word. Chutney. Chutney means to lick. And it's very appropriate because, you know, frankly, you'll be licking your lips, you know, each time you have it. Chutney is basically a balance of sweet, savory, and slightly spicy or heaty elements. So, for example, the chutney that we launched, it's the first product we launched in the marketplace. It's a red vine tomato chutney with fresh ginger and garam masala. Garam masala is a spice blend made up of an array of different spices like cumin, cloves, black cumin, a variety of different spices. And each family tends to have their own recipe for making garam masala. And so basically what happens is these vine tomatoes are cooked like a jam with sugar, with vinegar, and, you know, then you add in the spices and it makes for a wonderfully sweet and savory compote to be used with cheeses, charcuterie, add a dollop into soup or into a marinara, drizzle it on vegetables. You have a wide array of uses and applications for it.
You really know your foods. I'm going to go. You're in business 3 years. What have you learned that you didn't know before going in that you'd pass on to other entrepreneurs?
Be ready to have all of your assumptions reversed. I think that's one of the first things. We always start with these preconceived notions of what it's going to be like. And let me tell you, we're wrong every time. And that is a good thing, because it means that you are learning, that you're open, and that you're flexible, which is, you know, key, because, you know, this was not an industry that I necessarily knew particularly well. I had a passion for the culinary aspects, and that's what mobilized, you know, my start to the business. But at the end of the day, it is a business. So in an industry with a very specific set of dynamics and language, and all of these, you know, are lessons that I've had to learn. So surround yourself with good people. And, you know, really enjoy the ride.
I'm going to turn it back to Dan for the last two questions.
Thank you. I'm curious, Naomi, have you thought about exporting your stuff outside the United States?
Absolutely. We are, well, we have still have a lot more to do in the United States. So that's the first thing. But I already started looking at the international markets from my first year, only because I wanted to understand the differences in buying behavior, price components, you know, what really would be required. Because remember, I came from banking, and actually I specialized in the emerging markets, particularly Africa and the Middle East. And you know, it's a world that I always wanted to go back to, you know, even if I was selling into it. So, yes, we're certainly exploring Canada, the United Kingdom, France, as well as the GCC countries. So sort of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, UAE. So we're in exploratory, we're at an exploratory stage. And I think we'll probably start dipping our toe round about early 2019.
I mean, my last question, I want to go back to Don's discussion with you on chutney. Do you actually physically make it or simply sell the ingredients?
No, we actually physically make it. It is my family recipes that we, or ones that I've written over the years, that we have then taken and worked with Cornell University to develop scheduled processes or formulas against which they can be produced. I'm physically there during the production, and we produce in a small batch way in a commercial kitchen, semi-automated commercial kitchen on the North Fork of Long Island. So, you know, pretty much in the middle of New York's wine country. And, but yeah, it's produced in a very small batch manner. We're not in a factory, you know, in a factory setting.
Will you have to abandon that small batch as your business grows?
We have a long way to go before we abandon small batch. So you can still move away from stovetop and still be producing your products in a small batch manner in, you know, kettles, sort of, you know, steam jacket kettles and other industrial equipment. So, you know, but it's a question of when you move from stovetop into industrial, your recipes, your process, your formulas, if you will, you know, will have to be modified in order to ensure that the customer experience does not change, because you want to make sure that you safeguard the quality of the product. If I cannot produce at the highest quality, then frankly, this is no fun for me anymore. So scalability, but within reason, with a view to ensuring that product quality, you know, does not drop.
Well, Naomi, thank you for answering all of my questions. I'll give it back to Don.
I wish we had more time, but unfortunately we don't. We've been talking with Naomi Mobed. So a link to her website will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this program and every other past and future Recalculating show. And you can also tell us what you'd like to hear on this program. Naomi, for our audience, your website again?
It's www.lebonmago.com.
Yeah, and again, spell it out for our audience.
LebonMago.com.
Thank you so much, Naomi, for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Ah. Well, Dusty, are you on?
Yes, I am, Don.
Okay. We're ready to go. Dan, are you ready? Dusty Staub is with us.
And yes, sir.
I have to keep remembering Dusty, not Rusty. Dan, 5 seconds. Dan, one thing I learned in corporate America was that no one wanted to take risks. That's why large corporations buy startups. Someone took a risk. Dusty Staub has written a book, and I love the title, A Call for Corporate Courage. Leadership expert shares how to take calculated risk in your career. I love the title, Dusty. I love the thought, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm going to ask a couple of questions and then turn it over to Dan. But my first question is, Dusty, what's your background and why did you come to write the book?
Well, gosh, that's a great question. My background is I ran crisis centers. I was a clinical director and executive director dealing with life and death issues when I was a young man. Then I worked with alcohol and drug treatment centers. And then I was a licensed marital and family therapist, and then I went to work for a behavioral sciences consulting firm and started my firm back in 1990, Staub Leadership International. And we bring emotional intelligence to bear so people can make better use of their intellectual quotient, and we kind of liberate the purpose, passion, and power of individuals, teams, and organizations. And so it's really about how to become more effective, more powerful, smarter, more capable, and more innovative.
You okay? Dusty,
I'm fine. There's some sort of cracking noise on here.
I don't know why. Let me see what's wrong. Dan, are you on?
I'm here.
I don't know where that crackling's from. Dusty, do us a favor and start over with your.
All right.
Give us 5 seconds and then start over. I don't know where the crackling came from. And anyway, please start.
All right. I started off running crisis centers, kind of life and death issues when I was a young man, then worked in mental health, and then I migrated to being a licensed marital and family therapist in private practice, and then I went to work for a behavioral sciences consulting firm, which seemed to make a big difference. I got to work with CEOs and organizations and help leaders become more effective. And about 1990, I started my company, Staub Leadership International, where we really work on liberating the purpose, passion, and power of individuals, teams, and organizations.
Well, that's interesting. But with that background, all right, but you decided to write a book. And what are the two or three main points of your book?
Well, one of the main points is that where your leadership stops, where your courage stops is where your leadership stops. And one of the biggest issues in corporate America and political America, for that matter, is that there's a big failure of nerve. And people are lacking one or more of the key acts of courage. And my breakthrough was taking courage and breaking it down into specific actions so people could understand where they were strong, where they were weak, and have a way of being able to actually build their courage quotient.
I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to turn it over to Dan because Dan's really a good inquisitor on this area.
Thank you. Welcome to the program, Dusty.
Thanks, Dan.
So, corporate courage. Give me, if you can, give me an example of a corporation that, from your perspective, lacks corporate courage.
Well, I can give you a lot of examples. Let's go with Kodak. Kodak actually came up with the digital imaging. They had all the patents on it, but they didn't have the courage to go with that. They kept writing the film down, down, down. Kodak is a mere shadow of what it once was. It made its most money by selling off billions of dollars worth of patents just recently. Motorola lacked the courage to leverage and move into new things. Nokia, same thing. What happens to an organization is they get comfortable doing what they do well. I think I heard you say that what happens is that big organizations buy small entrepreneurial organizations because they're doing something the big organizations have lacked the nerve to do or have been unable to do. So you can go through example after example of what happens when courage is missing. We can go through integrity examples like Enron, et cetera.
So if we look at those two kinds of examples, is the lack of courage, and let's look at your, we can talk about your Kodak example for one. You could look at Xerox, you could look at Motorola, the things you talked about. You talked about being comfortable.
Yes. Status quo.
Pardon me?
People fall in love with the status quo.
Right. That, hey, it ain't broke, why should we fix it?
Exactly.
And that attitude creates a situation where they don't see either evolution of new technologies or competitors nipping at their heels that all of a sudden have overtaken them. But in addition to the management of the company, since the three companies we just put on the table were all public companies, and those companies have boards of directors, where's the responsibility of the board of directors?
Boards of directors very often tend to be rubber stamps for what the strong CEO wants. And having a strong board of directors, which brings some strategic guidance, is very helpful. The problem is many of the boards of directors are composed of senior leaders from other big organizations, and they have the same blinders on. And, you know, there's I will tell you this. From now 35 years of consulting experience, I've not met one CEO who failed because they weren't smart enough. Every failure, every CEO who's been fired that I've read about and studied about was fired because of a failure of nerve. They either lacked the courage to confront and deal with an issue that the organization had to address, or a colleague who'd been with them for a while, or they lacked the courage to be confronted to hear the bad news, and they got blindsided. And as we both know, when you get blindsided in an organization for which you're responsible, it's almost never good.
But do we have a I'm a registered investment advisor. I've been managing money for 45 years. Don't we have a different business model today in the sense that there is greater activity on the part of shareholders in trying to shape or change or mold or move the direction of the company than ever before?
Yes, I agree. And I think that's actually a good thing. I think it's still in its infancy, though.
So what kind of services, besides your book, do you provide other services for corporate leaders who begun to realize that their past is catching up with them and they need to change?
Yeah, let me give you a term I've coined. I call it the effective intelligence of an organization. One of the things we do is we work with teams and departments and senior leaders to help multiply the effective intelligence of their organization. What we find is that there's more intelligence, more capability, more ingenuity, more engagement available in the human system of most organizations than they tap. A good organization maybe gets 30-40% of what is capable of the people and the systems within it, and that's a good organization. And multiplying that intelligence, there are tools. There are the power questions, there's active listening, there's strategic perspective, there's identifying critical human systems factors, there's identifying the essential behaviors, the 5 or 6 core supervisory practices we want across our organization that's going to really engage people and bring out the best. And building a sense of psychological safety, absolutely essential for all those things.
One of the things that I would like to spend a moment talking about is that in many cases, in many corporations, success becomes your enemy. And I never forget the many of the illustrations that were used about some of the technology companies. For the one of the oldest, IBM. IBM had tremendous growth, but it kind of stopped. And yes. The reality of one of the reasons why it stopped is that it was still doing business, still generating revenue, but its ability to grow its business was a function of how big the business had already grown. You can grow a $5 billion business, but if you're a $50 or $100 billion or $250 billion business in a particular business segment, you're the dominant leader and you control significant market share, it's hard to grow your business anymore.
Yes. Yes. Doing what you've always done, absolutely. I'm looking at Google now, looking at our Alphabet. The interesting thing will be, will Google seems to have a lot of courage, and they seem to be doing a lot of things right. Will they continue to push the edges? And they have a very radical philosophy about how they go about looking at businesses and creating new businesses. But you used IBM, so let's go back and look at IBM for a second. John Akers was the CEO of IBM. He participated, he'd grown up in it. He was a very driven, very smart guy. And yet his board fired him because IBM's share price dropped down to like $44 or $45 a share from $160 or $170. And they went out and hired a marketing guy, Lou Gerstner, from RJR Nabisco. And Gerstner came in and he said, all right, we got to remember what our core reason is, why people want to buy Big Blue. And he got them going back to some of their core, but he also then focused on the services division. It's been the services division that has helped IBM grow. So businesses have to be willing to try new things, venture into new ways, building and leveraging off their base. But that takes courage. And Dan, where they lack that, that's where they start going down the chute.
So if we look at, let's talk about another segment, and then I'll give it back to Don in a minute or so. But let's look at a segment that's just going into absolute collapse, regardless of who you are. Almost. That's the American retail sector, especially the retail sector in bricks and mortar. I mean, the number of retail outlets, I saw a number recently that they believe by the end of this year, there will be between 8 and 10,000 retail stores, primarily related with chains, that will close in America. And the problem is that the spillover effect, as these big chains close stores, little chains go out of business, and mall operators are finding higher and higher vacancies, many of the mall operators are in trouble. So there's a spillover effect of one to the other. Is that retail industry as we've known it in the past, bricks and mortar, not only dying, but is it dead?
Oh, that's a great question. There is a huge bloodbath in retail. And what it is the online onslaught that people could have seen coming maybe 10 years ago, but brick-and-mortar retailers tended to avoid or not deal with. But it's not necessarily the end. Look at Apple stores. They're thriving. So there are certain stores, certain retail segments that can thrive, but it's going to have to be a different kind of intelligence. It's going to be blending with your online offerings, with the brick and mortar. And I know more and more young millennials and in my own family, we like going to certain stores. We like going out, but we're very picky about which stores we go to. So I don't think that they're dinosaurs, but they do need to reinvent themselves, and there's going to be a reckoning that's going to be very costly.
I look at the quarterly reports on Sears and the Sears Holding Company. they're closing more and more stores. Their Kmart operation is closing stores. A lot of these retailers are either closing or going. Toys R Us is selling now. Toys R Us is closing all of their stores. Kids R Us and their logo are all up for sale. And the word I hear is that there's a very keen interest in owning the names Toys R Us, Kids R Us, and Joffrey, the giraffe. But they're closing all their stores. They get out of the business totally. I mean, that's a place where we used to shop. But all the people that spun off to try and build similar stores to Toys R Us are all gone. I mean, that space is gone, and I don't know how you bring it back. I really don't. We just had an interview with a young woman who started a spice company, and she started from the very beginning on the internet, and she's talking about her next move is her presence on Amazon, but they're giving some consideration of opening a singular bricks and mortar store. And we've had a number of guests on the show who built a very successful business on the internet who are contemplating. But clearly you get a sense of concern about going in to the overhead expense and the cost of operating a bricks and mortar store, about whether they really should be in that or should they be concentrating more of their efforts in expanding their presence.
I'm going to jump in here, Dan, because the Supreme Court has just put an interesting nail into the internet by saying that the states and localities can impose a sales tax on internet sales. And it's taken 2 days for – I just saw something come across the desk, and I'll ask Dusty. Now, if you're a person of courage or a manager of courage, do you see that as a way – of bringing back your store into the mainstream?
Well, it depends on the store. It depends on location, and it depends on what you're offering and how you exhibit, how you put it out there. I would say that the Supreme Court ruling is going to cost online companies more. It's going to take away that tax-free advantage that people had shopping online. And so it makes it just a little bit less attractive. There's still the convenience factor. But I'm going to go back to what I said a little bit ago. More and more people are wanting to have a chance to walk into a brick-and-mortar store, to actually touch something, to try it on, to see it, to taste it, to feel it. But it has to be the right mix. It has to be the right offering. And you have to be in the right location to do that. So I think a big part of this is being very courageous and looking out there very boldly and saying, okay, what's the reality? What's the best we can predict about what's likely to happen? And how do I want to define myself? For instance, when Apple decided to put out brick-and-mortar stores, I didn't think that was going to work. But it's worked beautifully for them, and it's helped them with their share price and their sales. But they did it very smart, and they did it right. And so, again, you have that online presence, if you need an online presence, and you then have a smart brick-and-mortar store that amplifies that, they actually synergize together, then strategically, yes, you can move forward. But I would say a lot of courage, asking a lot of good advice, getting a lot of input, and thinking about it hard before you commit.
Go ahead, Dan.
I got a piece of news this morning that goes along with what you just reported. I was at a conference this morning with a bunch of CPAs, and this is their take of the Supreme Court, and I'd be interested to hear what Dusty has to say. They actually believe that Supreme Court ruling will destroy small internet businesses, and this is why they said it. Once you start promoting your product on the internet and you have to start collecting taxes, you have to be able to provide tax return information for potentially over 40,000 tax jurisdictions in the United States. There is no internet business that can perform the reporting requirements to all the tax jurisdictions. If you sell in where I live in Lee County, you're going to have
to. That's because they don't listen to our program. If you remember, two years ago, we had a man on the show who sold his company for $100 million to Microsoft. And what does he do? He provides to small businesses tax information on every of the 40,000 taxing locations and automatically takes the records, takes each sale and puts it into a reporting file so that they can do it. He was on our program, one of our first guests, if you remember, Dan. And yeah. And when I saw, I said $100 million, I'm sorry. He sold it for only $52 million. But, you know, and, you know, people say, well, why do you need that? Well, I guess he was more prescient than a lot of other people. But,
right.
But Dusty, we're talking over you, and you're the guest. But I was going to go a different direction and ask you a different question about courage. And it came up in the USA Today. They called me on this. You're an executive at an airline, and the airlines have been cramming more and more seats into smaller and smaller airplanes. You have to make a decision between improving your passengers' experience or improving the bottom line. What do you recommend under your principles an individual should be doing, a manager should be doing?
Well, you have to look at both. And one of the things that I say to people, wherever they are in an organization, you got to remember who actually pays you. It's not your corporation. It's that end customer who's buying your product or service. And in that sense, we're all in service. And if we alienate those customers, if they don't feel like that the value they're getting for what they're paying, the value equation for them, doesn't mix, they'll find another way to go. And so I think that what a CEO or senior leader for an airline has to do is think about what's the experience of my customer, my client, what's the bottom line, and how do I reconcile this? Now, you could really drive up your bottom line short term. This is what IBM did, by the way, under Johnny Akers. They incentivized their sales team to go out and sell more but to spend less time with key customers, and they crashed and burned like 2 years later. So if I really just up my bottom line, this is one of the dangers of looking at things quarter to quarter, by the way, is that if I have analysts looking at things quarter to quarter and I have to improve every quarter, I'm going to sacrifice the long-term health of my organization and probably put it at huge risk. And so some of it is the courage of saying to analysts and saying to people and my board and my investors, look, here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. Here's how it's going to work. And we're going to have a few times where we're not going to be as high as we could be, or we're going to even be down. But it's part of our strategy. And here's why it works. It's worked for Amazon. You know, it's working for Tesla. So it could work if you have the courage and you have the guts and the heart to make the tough call, saying we've got to keep the customers as happy as we can, and we've got to watch that bottom line. So it's a both and for me. It's a matter of managing that equation. And if it was easy to do, anybody could do it.
Yes, but Dusty, it's been my experience. That's maybe one of the reasons why I've been an entrepreneur most of the latter half of my life. But inside corporations, they're ruled by fear. If you make the wrong decision, somehow or other you're going to be hurt by it. And, you know, and once you pass a certain level, it seems that you move upward and onward from failure to failure. It's almost like it's a two-way failure. Below a certain level, you're knocked out. Failure above a certain level, that means you get another job. I mean, that to me, in all my, you know, I've been covering corporations for years, and I've seen this in so many places. You can comment out and tell me I'm all wet, but what do you think?
No, I totally agree with you, and that's the thesis. What I'm putting out there is that the fear runs us, fear of failure. fear of being seen as weak, fear of falling on my face. You know, Mary Kay Ash created Mary Kay Cosmetics when everybody said nobody can build a business on the backs of stay-at-home moms. Well, she proved them wrong. Satira Honda built a Honda Motor Company, and both of them had a philosophy which was called fail forward. How can we teach employees to fail forward? And they didn't punish people for failure or mistakes. They rewarded them if they were the right kinds of mistakes. We didn't repeat the same mistake. We did our due diligence. We did our homework. It was for the greater good. You checked in with sources that could have helped prevent which could have guaranteed greater success, and you did do that. So if you hit those criteria, then you help fail the organization forward. So Chair Honda said, look, the only way forward is to fail quickly, learn from it, and move on to the next failure. And so for me, one of the things is what happens with most of corporate America, especially as they get to a certain level, and this was documented by Dr. Chris Argyris at Yale University, said the most successful people later in their career become the least successful people because they get blinded or hypnotized by their past success. They stop learning. They become more and more careful, cautious, anxious about making a mistake and slipping down the ladder, and therefore they make the biggest career mistake, the biggest mistakes for their businesses they could.
I think you're so right. But with the remaining time, let's turn it around. Small business people are, by and large, they jump off the cliff and hope somebody builds a swimming pool before they land when they start out. But at some point, they become very conservative and almost rigid. Have you seen that?
I have. A third of our business is with small family-run businesses. A third is with big corporations, and the third is in the healthcare field. And what I would say is I see people start off with the courage to dream, and they have the courage to take action. And even within entrepreneurs, though, Don, what I see is that people lack one. There's seven acts of courage, just very quickly. The courage to dream, the courage to take action, the courage to confront, the courage to be confronted, the courage to learn and grow, the courage to be vulnerable and open, and the courage to take action. And one of the things I see is that in every entrepreneur, they're not strong in all seven. So let's say they don't have the courage to be confronted. Therefore, bad news comes up. People have a different point of view that's important to listen to. They don't. And so that's where they stumble. Or they lack the courage to confront and hold someone accountable who's been with them for a while, but the company's outgrown that person. And so that becomes their stumbling block. Or they lack the courage to be vulnerable and ask for help. Those are the three big ones I see in most corporations, either a lack of the courage to confront, or the lack of the courage to be confronted, or the lack of the courage to be vulnerable. And the fourth one, is another big one, is they lack the courage to learn and grow, which means to step into ambiguity, into the unknown, to take a calculated risk, and or to give up the need to be right. And so if when I'm working with an entrepreneur or a CEO in a Fortune 500 company or somebody in healthcare, it's all around which of these acts you're strongest in, which one have you least developed, because the one you've least developed is the one that's going to trip you up later in your career. And by the way, if you don't address it, it's going to suck down one of the other acts of courage that is a strength for you right now. So it's a matter of seeing it, addressing it, and dealing with it before it can bite you on the rear end.
I'm going to turn it over to Dan, but your website where people can find the book and more about you?
Yes. The website is staubleadership.com, and Staub's just S-T-A-U-B. And Rusty Staub's a third cousin of mine, so if you remember the spelling of his last name, staubleadership.com. And the name of the book is really The Seven Acts of Courage, Bold Leadership for a Wholehearted Life.
Back to you, Dan.
Dusty, I have one question to ask you, then unfortunately, we have to move on. I'm doing a consulting piece right now with a startup company, and they have amazing technology, world-changing technology. And one of the things that we're talking about is an exit strategy. And I'm pounding on the table. The exit strategy is no exit. Because once you become a public company, the challenges that you have with reporting to the various research groups and brokerage firms and everything else, you begin to lose control of your company. And I've seen companies that were private, went public, and turn around when went private again.
Yeah.
Going public is not the panacea that a lot of people think that it is. And what do you talk to people about privatizing or never going public?
That's a great question, Dan. And I know we don't have a lot of time. So what I would say is you've got to decide what matters most to you. Is it being able to really nurture your child, see its full growth, and then pass it on? Or is it to cash out, sell, and then see what someone else does with it in the publicly traded sphere? I advise people to keep their organizations private, where they have control, where they can manage the quality, where they can continue to invest and grow it, and make sure they have a good succession plan in place. Or if they're going to sell it, think about the idea of how you sell it and how you package it. As you know from your consulting, you can package things in lots of different ways.
Yes.
For instance, one of my clients put together more than 200 orthopedic surgeons, created a group, and they sold 40% of the group for millions of dollars to a venture capital firm, but they maintained 60%. They got their cash out, and yet they're still in control. So there are ways to do this,
yes.
You know, and you have to be really smart. And you need a really smart advisor, Dan, probably like you and Don.
So, Dusty, thank you so much for joining us today. Back to you, Don.
It was a pleasure talking to you guys.
So, Dusty, we'll have a...
Are you there? Here
yes.
I am, Dan. I'm sorry. We had a glitch in the studio. Anyway, we've been talking to Dusty Staub. A link to his website will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this and every other program. And you can take a short survey where you can tell us what you'd like to hear on this program. Dusty, thank you so much for being with us. It was really illuminating.
Don, it was my pleasure. It was great talking to you and Dan. And just keep on doing what you're doing, gentlemen.
Have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Maureen, are you on? Marion.
Marion, it is, actually.
Right.
Yes,
yes, Marion. Okay, let me go. I'm sorry about the mix-up, but you're here, thankfully.
Yep.
Okay. We're going to talk about the gig economy, right, Marion?
Correct.
Okay. Give us 5 seconds of silence. Dan, small businesses are starting to embrace the gig economy. Everybody's talking about it, but we have here today someone who knows an awful lot about it. She's Marion McGovern. Marion, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure, Don.
Well, Marion, we have a lot of questions, but first, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to look at the gig economy so closely.
Well, you know, Don, I started a company... I'm dating myself 30 years ago now. That was a gig economy company before anybody ever coined the term. So I started a firm that matched independent consultants with businesses and grew that business to be bi-coastal anyway, if not nationwide, and then sold it to a South African conglomerate in 2005. Along the way, I also started another company that was an employment compliance company, because one thing about the gig world is the question of, are these people contractors or are they employees? And that has been a problem that has been around well before anyone raised it around some of, you know, the gig platforms like Grubhub and Uber. But it's kind of been my life for 30 years. Even when I was out of it, I... consulted back to it, and then about 3 years ago, three different investor groups actually wanted me to consult about their talent platforms, and in all these cases, they were trying to create organizations that where algorithms would kind of do a lot of the work that the people did, and my my view was, you know, if people are the most important part of your business, why do you want to keep trying to take people out of the picture? So I decided to jump back in and see what was going on with how technology was being applied to labor markets and to independent work in particular. And that led to my most recent book, which is Thriving in the Gig Economy.
Wow. That's very succinct. I have a lot of questions, but first one, will you define the gig economy? I've heard different things. How do you define the gig economy?
Thank you for that question, because it is really important that everybody's on the same page, and people do define it differently. So the way I look at it, I look at the actual definition of the word gig, which is work of uncertain duration for multiple clients or employers. And it actually started back in the 1920s with jazz musicians who had a club date a couple of nights on one side of town and then maybe a week in another side of town, and that was a gig. So independent work like that has been around for a long time, whether you called it gigs or moonlighting or side hustles or independent work or independent consulting or being self-employed. I mean, it's been around for a long time. What changed was this advent of technology applied to the problem. So then there were these platforms that were created that was kind of the on-demand world is the way I look at it. So on-demand would be your driving services, you know, Uber and Lyft. You want that person in 2 minutes, if not sooner. You want your Chinese food delivery really quickly, if not sooner. So that's kind of the on-demand world. One thing I do not include in the definition of the gig world is the sharing economy. So the sharing economy being exemplified by Airbnb, if you will. The fact, I know it takes work to be an Airbnb host, but if I am going to get that condo in Colorado, it's because it's available when I want it. It's got the right number of bedrooms. It's close to the resort I want to go to, and it's at the right price point. How good a host you are really doesn't play into it. So that is a sharing economy play. I do not include that when I talk about the gig world. You know, some people do include that, especially when they're looking at gigs as a way to get additional income. And certainly Airbnb hosts are getting additional income in a non-traditional way. But for me, the whole sharing world is a different world.
Well, that is about as succinct a definition. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to turn it over to Dan.
Hi, Dan.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I in fact, am a gig person. I am not an employee. I work for lots of different corporations, primarily in writing, in commentary and things like that. In my money management practice, I work for my company, but I don't work. I'm not paid by my clients. My clients pay my company. But there are. I'm also an author, and I use the gig economy through an organization you may be familiar with called Fiverr.
Yep.
I use them to find an illustrator for my children's books, and I'm doing a consulting practice right now. Where we have a technology company that's a startup, and I'm trying to work with them in the idea of let's not try and build an enormous amount of overhead. Let's try and see what we can find in the gig economy to bring in resources as we grow and evolve. And I'm getting some favorable response to that. There's another organization called Freelancer. Are you familiar with them?
Yes. There's freelancer.com, and then there's also the Freelancers Union, which is more of a resource group for independent workers.
So
I don't know which one you're referring to.
Freelancers.com. But uh-huh. My question is, I use those just two as an example of many. The internet has created or should I maybe phrase it a different way. Do you believe that the internet has created an opportunity for more people to get involved in the gig economy because of organizations like Fiverr and Freelancer, which provide opportunities to get information to independent contractors about what might be available?
Absolutely. So the technology has, in essence, made the markets more efficient. You know, there always were these workers out there, but now there's an easy way to identify them. And I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is there are so many platforms out there. There are platforms for, you know, writers like Scripted and Contently, and there are platforms for technical people like Fiverr's Largely Technical, Upwork is another one. TopTal is another one that is almost all developers, but there are platforms for data scientists, you know, at the upper end of the expertise spectrum, if you will. There are platforms for snowplow drivers, for makeup artists, for people to work at rock and roll shows. I mean, there are platforms for so many things, and a lot of people don't know that they're out there. As part of my research for the book, I actually joined 10 of them to sort of see what the experience was like. A few really shouldn't have taken me, but they did anyway. And then I also became a client of several. Fiverr was one of them. But I wanted to sort of understand what was it like to be a client. And like you, I am still a gig worker, so I actually use more people on Upwork these days because they're here in my backyard. But, you know, I have an Upwork person that does all of my email marketing and updates my website, and I've used them for SEO stuff. I've used Zintro, another sort of specialty expert platform for market research. I mean, you could get so much work done just by understanding how to projectize your work and to bring in the resource to do that project.
Some people think that the explosion of the gig economy was a result of the decisions that corporations made after the Great Recession in 2008. I'm in my early 70s, and I've been through a lot of market cycle downturns. And in the market crash of 1987, corporate America made a decision, which I thought was the wrong decision, but because the economy took a huge dive, that they decided that it was better off to keep the people at the top and the bottom and to get rid of the middle. And I never thought that was a smart idea, except that it presented an opportunity for me to do consulting work for over 20 years, filling in for all the people that they let go. But I wonder, since we had another major recession in 2008 and corporate America again downsized, this time as they came back, the opportunity to use the gig economy allowed corporations to add resources without adding to overhead in the corporation. Now, with that said, what I'm concerned about is now we have a 3.8% unemployment rate. We have parts of the country where the unemployment rate is 2 or lower. We have the lowest unemployment rate in perhaps decades in both the Black and Hispanic community. There's a shortage of labor. Have these people who've been in the gig economy, are they moving back into the corporate sector where they're getting full-time paid jobs?
There's a lot to unpack in that question. So keep me honest in my answer if I don't get to something. First, I totally agree with you relative to a lot of this started happening back in the corporate dislocations of the 80s. And quite frankly, that is when you got the professional cadre of independent consultants in various management disciplines. You know, there always been independent workers around, but you know, now all of a sudden you had senior HR people, finance people, marketing people who decided they didn't want to go get riffed again somewhere else, and they would just hang out their shingle. So when I started my company in 1988, I was coming from the consulting world. I was an ex-Booz Allen person, and I was surprised to find the vast number of people that were already out there doing this independently, but nobody knew about it. So fast forward, you had a few things in between now, then and 2000, the crash of 2007, not the least of which was the Enron debacle. So as you had a certain generation that started singing that, you know, the corporate career doesn't last forever, memories can be short, and the new people coming up might not have like necessarily seen that. But then you had kind of Enron happen, where all of a sudden again you had this other version of, oh, you know, what really is job security? And the people that have looked at what has happened since the recession of 2007 have pointed out that now a whole other generation has that same view. So the whole notion of the social contract between the company and the employee is probably at the lowest level it's been in years, which isn't to say that companies aren't figuring that out. I mean, Glassdoor has made its fortune on figuring out how to be an employer of choice, and people realize that talent matters and talent's really important and they have to treat their employees well. So we have a couple of countervailing things going on at the same time. So I think my view of, I don't want to say the future of work, because quite frankly, there are a lot of futures that could happen. I think the notion of a portfolio career is what is going to happen. So people will be employed for a while, then they'll go off and consult, and maybe they'll go back and be employed because it's an interesting opportunity, or it's an opportunity to upskill their own human capital, but then they'll go off and consult again. So I think, you know, now we may be seeing more people going internally because of the unemployment rate, as you point out. But I recently heard the stat that the average employee is an employee in a tech company in Northern California. So that, granted, may not be true of the whole country, but the tenure is 14 months. 14 months is a long time. 14 months is like a long gig. So I think we will have this more mobility in the workforce, whether they're as employees or consultants or kind of a hybrid of both.
One of the things that we've been talking to people about for the last almost year became more heightened in October of last year when they changed the tax bill. America operated under Barack Obama and the Democratic Party with a philosophy that America's best years were behind it. We would never see 3% GDP again. The jobs that left the country were not coming back. And so there wasn't a real sense of hope and opportunity within America. And we had almost 8 years of that. Now we have a totally different scenario. We've got low unemployment. We've got wages rising. We've got shortage of people in many different sectors of the economy. And what we're finding is we talk to people who do surveys, Marian, what we're finding is that business leaders are uncomfortable with making decisions because perhaps much of their business life has been in times that were not perceived to be productive, and they don't know how to function in the kind of economy that we have and we may be having for a number of years going forward. When I ask you the question about people coming back to full-time jobs, the management of business needs help because they are ill prepared to deal with this economy, and perhaps gig employees be turned into real employees because of the shortage of personnel.
Well, but one thing that will temper that is the fact that all of the studies you read, and there are lots of people that do studies on this particular space, 70% of the 53 million people that are working independently are doing it by choice. So they want to work that way. And a very high number, I want to say it's 49%, has said they won't go back to regular employment regardless of the price. So there is this aspect of flexibility and control. And I think, quite frankly, control over your time, control over your life, control over the kind of work you do is even more important in the current environment where you've got a very hectic pace of business, and
yeah,
it can be stressful. So, you know, understanding your own or making sure that you are creating your own future is what most of these independent workers want. And
right,
quite frankly, that's one of my pet peeves, is that there are so many people that look upon the independent workers as, oh, these are just guys that couldn't get, you know, couldn't get a regular job. And no, they're not. They're, you know, entrepreneurial. They're putting out their, they're putting their kind of career on the line and saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to create my own future. And, you know, watch me. So we should honor that and we should respect that entrepreneurial choice. And we really need to give more dignity to the independent workers than some people tend to do.
Right. Let me ask you one more question, then I'll turn it back to Don. Do you see any difference in the gig approach based on different generations currently working in the workforce?
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, I think a lot of people don't appreciate the number of boomers that are out there doing it. In fact, it was only last year that millennials became the larger cohort. But what surprised me is that millennials especially will use the gig economy to upskill. And sometimes they'll use it to upskill even when they're employed. And the example that was given to me was a technology firm where you have, you know, software developers doing different things and programming in different languages, and somebody wants to get on the Python team because that's, you know, that's the up-and-coming team, but they don't have the Python background. So, and the company doesn't have the training program to do it. So the worker will go learn Python on their own, as software developers do. I know because my son's one. They'll learn it on their own. They'll go on some platform and they'll get some Python gigs. And then all of a sudden they have the Python experience. And by virtue of doing that side hustle to upskill themselves, they have a better trajectory in their current company.
And they have a stronger resume.
Correct.
Yeah. Don, back to you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to go in a different direction and ask this question. It's a fact that we have so many now laws over 50, under 50, EEO, et cetera. Is that also making companies wary of hiring full-time people when they end even the Obamacare going over 50 employees? Has that also contributed to the gig economy?
You know, perhaps, but I don't think it's as big a factor as just the sheer desire of the workers to work this way. And quite frankly, there is a dimension of, you know, when I started my business 30 years ago, if you couldn't make it as a consultant on your own, you kind of had to go back to being a regular worker. But now, a regular employee, shall we say. But now with the explosion of opportunities out there, if you can't get your digital marketing practice going, well, you know, you can drive for Uber for a while to make ends meet. So there are a lot more opportunities to gain income. And I think when people are deriding the benefitless dimension of some of the gig platforms, they're missing the fact that for many it is supplemental. For many, you know, there are some people who are driving full time for Uber, but there are an awful lot that are doing it to supplement an existing job or to enable another pursuit.
We're talking with Marion McGovern. Marion, your website for people?
MarionMcGovern.com.
Okay. Well, we want to get a plug in because you're so interesting. Well, let's go in another direction. I've been out of the corporate world for a long time, gone in and out of it for about 20 years after my last full-time gig. But it always has been in a 1 or 2 or 3 year cycle where I was brought in to do a specific job. Is that becoming more and more of the norm amongst bigger companies?
Yeah, you know, I think partly there was a huge movement in the technology space towards agile operations. So agile operations was the idea that instead of doing these software development projects that went on forever and ever and then kind of ended up never finishing the project, they adopted an agile methodology where every day there was kind of a scrum, as they would call it, and they'd get things done on a quick basis and prototype things quickly and get things into operation quickly. So it really changed how systems were getting developed. And so that methodology has gone through to the whole notion of the agile organization. So, you know, let's bring in the talent we need. Let's make it happen quickly. Let's prototype quickly. Let's fail quickly if we're going to pivot and redirect. And so what they are doing is they're kind of bringing in that talent to do that. In some cases, it may be, as you say, it may be episodic. You know, I know one marketing consultant that goes in and she does, you know, in reports and 10-Qs, and that's all she does. She goes in for different clients and does that, and they don't have to have a regular employee do that. So there are lots of ways that companies deploy this kind of talent.
Well, I'm going to tell you a tale of 20 years ago, a chemical bank, I'll name the bank because they're no longer with us, brought in a group of programmers to work on a new payment system. And one of the programmers, who's a temporary, wrote a program that's, and at the end of it, he simply had it put any, if there was a half penny or a fraction of a penny, it would go into his account. And it took him 7 years to find out. You imagine how much money he made on that deal.
Yep.
Which brings you to the point. The National Security Agency hired a guy, Snowden, and he took all their secrets. How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, you know, there are bad actors out there. There's nothing you do about it. But a lot of things are governed contractually. So people have, quite frankly, the consultants need the protection as much as the clients do. So I advise any independent to make sure that they have certain things in writing. Clearly, a lot of companies, especially tech companies, would want non-disclosure agreements with proprietary information. You know, whenever I talk to folks in new and growing companies, you know, they have to make sure that they identify stuff as proprietary in order for it to be protected under those agreements. But there should be information about there should be agreements about proprietary information, what's proprietary, what isn't, what's acceptable use, what isn't. There should be sections on intellectual property. You know, if you're coming in and you are bringing your ideas about how to build something, is that typically because you're under contract, that's work for hire, so that belongs to the company and you have to understand that. So, you know, there are, especially at the more sophisticated levels of consulting, there are things to be documented and assured before you start. But, you know, I'm very optimistic because there are cool entrepreneurs that are getting involved in the space, one of which in this particular area is a company called Bunker Insurance. And Bunker Insurance offers professional liability insurance for independent consultants. It used to be that was way too expensive for an independent consultant to get. In fact, back in the day, my firm used to get people coming to us saying, gee, I'd like to do this. I've gotten this great project with ABC Technology, but I can't afford to have a $10 million liability insurance policy. Can I do this through you? Well, now Bunker has created a platform where it's reasonably priced professional liability insurance that protects both the company and the consultant. So, you know, there are cool entrepreneurs figuring out the problems in the marketplace to help enable this movement even more.
That is really something. Would you mind repeating it? Because I know that's a question that's thrown at me every time I talk at an event. Will you repeat the company, please?
Bunker Insurance. Bunker like a trap on a golf course. So Bunker Insurance. And, you know, one thing that they did, which is very cool, is it used to be that you used to have to get a policy for everything. Bunker allows you to get a policy just for that one project that might require it.
That's really fantastic. Dan, I'm turning it back to you for the last two questions.
I don't think we have time for two, but I'll do one. Barry, did I hear you say you have a book?
I have a book, yes, called Thriving in the Gig Economy. I have another one, but that was a while ago, called A New Brand of Expertise. That's also about kind of the freelancing world.
So the new one is Thriving in a Gig Economy?
Correct.
And is it available on Amazon?
It's available on Amazon. It's available at MarianMcGovern.com. I go into sort of the history of the movement, as we were discussing. But I also talk about, you know, the various platforms, how to work with the platforms. I talk about digital branding and the importance of that, but also the importance of actually getting out and talking to people. You know, I have this fear that with all the, you know, digital content out there, that people think if they just keep putting up blogs and tweeting on things that, you know, business will come. Well, you know, business comes from people, and you actually have to meet the people. So that's part of the deal too.
So you basically
But I talk about ecosystems.
But you've created, it sounds like, Marian, that you've created a how-to book that people who are interested in getting involved with the gig economy should read.
Yeah, and I would say companies too, because there are things they need to know. One of my biggest fears, quite frankly, is around the employment issues, where a lot of the platforms, when I was kind of boring and nerdy and I read all these contracts that they had, and they pretty much say, look, you know, this person might be an employee or might be a contractor. We have nothing to do with it. You have to decide. And I think there are probably a lot of young management teams out there of new companies that have no idea that there's this minefield of employee independent contractor legislation or law out there that's very ambiguous. And as much as they think they just keep hiring this consultant for 60 hours a week because they're a startup, you know, that could be really bad. That could look like an employee, and you could get in trouble. So it's important for the client side, so the folks who are gigging their businesses to understand it as well.
Thank you, Don.
Yeah, we've been talking with Marian McGovern. She's given us an awful lot of information on the gig economy. A link to her website will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this and every other Recalculating show. You can also tell us what you'd like to hear from us in terms of guests. Marian, your website again for people and your book?
It's MarianMcGovern.com. And you can also find me on LinkedIn at Marian McGovern. That's my Twitter handle, and the book is called Thriving in the Gig Economy.
Well, we've been thriving thanks to you, and thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real
pleasure. My
pleasure.
It was fun. All right.
Thank you.
Have a great day, guys.
From major, I don't put the number in. Together the recalculating media world each week touches 2+ million sector decision makers with original content advice at the top. VistaPrint's special quarter promotion will receive a 30-second ad on every Recalculating Radio program, 26 times in total over the 13-week cycle. The show is heard twice a week. VistaPrint can sponsor.
You're only doing one commercial a week on one show?
On two shows. On two
okay.
shows, one commercial.
The same commercial for both shows?
Yes.
Okay, so that's $7,150 per show, per week.
Whatever. Now, VistaPrint can also sponsor a 30-30 small business advice inserts. Can sponsor, you don't need the A. Insert containing helpful hints on adding profit to small business leaders bottom line brought to them by national columnist Dan Perkins. This will run on 25 additional stations, and in the Recalculating Radio shows.
So we've got 14,300 in the first piece.
Uh-huh.
And the second piece, if she wants to do the 30-30, just on the 25 stations, it's 32,500. Are you now
right.
saying that the 30-30 would also go on the 11 recalculating?
Well, it makes sense. You want it on both. And what we say is, should Vista Print accept this package? This package, it will run on recalculating gratis. That takes care of gratis.
So if they agree to the 25 stations with a 50-50, they get the 11 stations on recalculating
free.
And do they get once a week or twice a week?
Twice a week.
Okay.
It's a good package.
So 14,300 or 46,500.
Or both.
Well, if they can have their choice, they can do 14,300 with just the recalculating, or they can do the 30-30 along with it. If they marry the two together, then that's 32,500 additional, so that the two combinations, which would be four commercials over two shows a week, would be 46,500.
I think it's a little too rich, but...
But what should it be?
I have no idea, Dan. I just can't see her going for a $46,000 package off the back. But I've been wrong before.
Well, but obviously what becomes important here is what do you want to price it at? I mean, if it's too rich, is it that the you're comparing 11 stations to 26 stations? So the cost to be on 26 stations is going to be more than the cost to be on 11 stations.
True.
So I don't know what you want to do.
What I want to do is think about it one day.
Okay.
Till tomorrow morning.
Okay.
And I'd like to send it to Mark and see what he thinks.
Okay.
Why don't you? I will send you the. What I've written out, I'll send you what I've written out, and then you say these are the figures. What do you think? Because you've got all the figures.
Okay. And then I send it back to you, and then you send it on to Mark, or you want me to send it?
No, you
on
send
Mark?
You send it to Mark.
Okay.
I'll send it to you right now.
Check your spelling. I think you got VistaPrint spelled wrong in the headline. and down in the body.
Well, then do me a favor. Check it all and make the change, okay?
Okay.
I've just sent it to you.
Okay.
It doesn't have a thing. Okay? And then we'll talk about it in the morning. Hopefully he'll get back to us. Tell him we have a call with her on Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
Let me check out what am I doing tomorrow morning. Hold on. I've got a 10 o'clock interview tomorrow morning, so I could do it after that. It's about half an hour, so we could talk about 10:30.
Okay.
And so we're going to – I'm going to rework it, send it to you, and then we're going to reconvene in the morning, and then whatever we decide in the morning is what we're going to modify and send it on to Mark for his thoughts.
Okay.
Right?
Say that again.
I will rework it, send it to you. You'll have a chance to think about it overnight. We'll talk tomorrow morning after 10:30. Once we've agreed on whatever the pricing is going to be, then we'll send it to Mark, telling him, here's the proposal for what we want to do for pricing, to a conversation with Vistaprint that you and I have on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Please give us your input.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I sent it to you.
All right.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Yeah, I just got to realize I got to shit. I was going to walk away and then not. I got to end the episode.